All right, then we shall begin. And good morning and welcome, everyone.
Good morning.
And again, just by way of brief introduction, I'm Michael Pellett. I'm a Lutheran pastor at King of Glory in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and I also teach philosophy at the University of Saskatchewan. And that keeps me out of trouble sometimes. Our overall summer theme for Holden is the many-colored grace of God. And of course, one of the places you can get many colors of grace are the parables that are presented in the Gospels. And what I'm doing this week is looking at five different parables where the bottom line, or the punchline, if you will, of the parable is that someone ends up unforgiven, which is hardly a very gracious thing. And so how is it that parables can talk about grace and at the same time end up in their climax with unforgiveness or non-forgiveness? And so that's the question, and again, that's what we'll try to work through today as we look at the parable of the unmerciful servant in Matthew chapter 18, verses 21 through 35. And so that's where the Bibles will come in to use that. Again, the title I'm using here, Debt, Disappointment, and Despair, Misdirected Grace. And what that means is that first and foremost, I'm sure that most of you as grace-filled people, like I, wake up every morning, take that first stretch and go, ah, another day of disappointment and despair. And if you happen to have the good fortune, like I did, to have breakfast with an august group of people this morning, you will add to that the codicil, and it's always worse than you think. So, with that, let's read Matthew chapter 18, verses 21 through 35. And again, I'll read for you my translation of it, the way I would interpret or translate this parable, and you can follow along, and then we'll get specific. So, beginning at verse 21. Then coming up to him, Peter said, Lord, how many times when my brother sins against me will I forgive him? As many as seven times? Jesus says to him, I say to you, not as many as seven times, but as many as 77 times. On account of this, the kingdom of the heavens would be similar to a man, a king, who had intended to settle accounts with his servants. But when he began the auditing, there was brought before him a debtor who owed $3 billion. And not having the amount to give back, the master ordered him to be sold, and his wife and children and everything which he possessed, and to be repaid. Therefore, falling down, the slave prostrated himself before him, saying, be big-hearted with me, and I will give you back everything. And moved by this gut-wrenching plea, the master of that slave released him and canceled for him the loan. And coming out, The slave found one of his co-slaves who owed him $4,800. And seizing him in a chokehold says, "Give back what you owe." Therefore, falling down, his co-slave begs him, saying, "Be big-hearted with me, and I will repay you." Now he was not willing to do this, but going out, he threw him into prison until he might pay back the debt. So his co-slaves, seeing the things that had happened, were deeply distraught, and going to the master himself, they laid out clearly all the things that had happened. Then summoning him, his master says to him, "Evil slave, all that debt I forgave you since you begged me. And is it not necessary for you to have had heart for your co-slave, as even I had a heart for you?" And being furious, his master handed him over to the torturers until when he might give back all that was owed to him. Thusly, also my Father who is in the heavens will do to you, unless each forgives one's fellows from the bottom of your heart. All right. Just a few things here in terms of getting the structure of the story. And that's what this little chart is about. There are three scenes, scene one, two, three. And each, right, very neatly has a little introduction, the first episode, the second episode, the third episode. Right? The first one is the king's accounting, second, the servant's accounting, and third, the king's response. And it breaks down nicely into verses, and again, you can see who's the key in the dialogue in all of this. So this is just here simply for helping us work through it, because we're going to go through scene one, two, three. Secondly, what we need to look at a little bit in terms of background and context is understanding what's going on here. And again, between the king and what's translated there as servant and co-servants and all, and how tax collection worked at the time. There's the king, or it can be the emperor, whether that's King Herod or Pontius Pilate as procreator of Judah, or the Roman emperor or whatever. When they want to get their taxes, what happens is the king auctions off the tax collection to the highest bidder. Right, so somebody will say, I'll collect taxes for you and I'll give you 6,000 talents. Right. Another one says, I'll give you 8,000. Another one, I'll collect the taxes, I'll give you the 10,000 talents. Well, king of course says, well, highest bidder gets it. So, deal, 10,000 talents. We signed the contract, right? This big tax collector or contractor, this is the servant in our story, will then subcontract out to various regions or villages or tariff booths to other folks who will actually do the hands-on collecting of the taxes. So subcontractor one will say, I'll handle this region. Subcontractor two says, well, you know, I'll collect the taxes in Capernaum. Subcontractor three will work the tariff booth like Matthew did, or someone like that. That's the co-servant in the story. And so again, a talent, as all these scholars who try to look at this in socioeconomic history and all of that, a talent in today's money now is about $300,000. And so that's why the contrast here is between figuring that out. $3 billion is what the big contract was for, and this subcontractor owes $4,800. So you can see a bit of a difference. The other thing here, just to set the context a little bit and to note what that is about, is that, again, as scholars have worked this out, their understanding is that yearly taxation for Judea at Jesus' time was about 600 talents, or in other words, $180 million. So in other words, you can see the hyperbole in this story, that if you will, the Romans themselves were only collecting 600 talents, and this story is 10,000 talents. If we would put it in our kind of colloquial language today, it would be that this tax collector contractor owed the king $1 zillion, right? Because 10,000 talents would be totally unfathomable to anybody, right? An unbelievable debt, perhaps even bigger than the current debt of the United States. Right? That much money. Yeah, hardly. Impossible. Holy, right? Impossible. But that's what we're going on here. And so then, with that as our background, we can go to scene one, which is the story of an accounting. Because what's going to happen here is, right, there's this contract that's been made for $3 billion. And this is the day of accounting, or this is the day of the audit. And so our tax collector contractor has to show up at the king and basically pay the money as the contract says. And we know he doesn't have the money, but we also know that he's trying to dodge this, because if you look at verse 24 very carefully, it's the notion of how this contractor was brought to the king. Right? In other words, he didn't voluntarily show up on the day he was supposed to. He's probably dragged in kicking and screaming, right? He's brought in to do this. And, of course, right, he doesn't have the money. And for whatever reason, it's not necessarily that, you know, he's just embezzled it all or anything, because, after all, you make the contract, and, of course, there's a risk. Because, for example, you said, okay, here it is, King, I'll pay you $3 billion, because that's what you think you can get from the people, and of course you'll charge a little more that you'll put in your own pocket. But what happens if, again, most of the folks are peasants and farmers, what happens if this happens to be a year of drought? And so there are no crops, not enough money, whatever, and so you've only collected $1 billion, right? You're in trouble, because the king doesn't care. Famine, no famine, whatever. All the king wants is $3 billion, right? Either you've got it or you don't. That's the accounting, that's the audit. And so, of course, in verse 25, we see here that he doesn't have the amount, and so therefore, and again, the vocabulary switches from king to master, orders that this person is sold as well as wife, children, everything else he possesses. Now again, this shows, or at least to the audience then, this would show that this is completely a Gentile undertaking. This is the way all these big bad Gentiles work. Because according to Jewish law, right, a wife and children cannot be sold to make up for the debts of a husband or father. So the mere fact that this can happen would tip off all the hearers, this is Gentile, right? This is how the big bad Gentiles work. And so it tips it off. The other thing here, and we sometimes get into a little trouble in our interpretation in terms of thinking, well, the reason this guy is sold or put in jail and wife and children are sold is because that's how he's going to get his money back. But again, as you well know, selling wife and kids isn't going to get you $3 billion. You don't sell them to get the money out of them, because you see, the issue here is what had been broken is the contract. And when you break the contract, you do not pass go, you go directly to jail. Right? And so in other words, the king is putting on this stringent punishment as a warning to everyone else, you don't renege on contracts, right? When you make a contract with me, you pay up or you go to jail. So that's why he's going to jail, because he broke the contract or he couldn't come up with the contract. And so therefore, there is the punishment. The servant or the contractor here, of course, tries to beg for mercy. Be big-hearted with me, the literal sense there of mercy and compassion. And again saying, I will give you back everything. And on the one hand you go, well, that's ridiculous. On the other hand, maybe not, because you see what he's doing here is saying, okay, look, we had a contract, let's keep the contract. In other words, what I can't give back to you, give that to me as a loan and contract out with me next year and I'll pay that plus what you've loaned me. Because, you know, maybe next year will be a good year. Maybe next year we'll all have bumper crops like we heard about yesterday. And then, who knows, he might be able to pay it off. Or he might be able to do it, you know, in 2, 3, 5 years, whatever. So in that sense, because of the exorbitant amount, on the one hand it's ridiculous, and yet, on the other hand, there's still, you know, that kind of snowball's chance in hell that he could pay it off, because he's going to, you know, just squeeze the people from whom he's collecting taxes harder in order to get it back. So he thinks, I could make a deal with the king, right, in terms of repayment. And then, of course, the surprise is that the king is moved by this gut-wrenching plea. And again, it's a great Greek word that if you pronounce it, you have to stand far away from people because you spit a lot. Right? The word there is splunknixthes. And literally what it means is to have your guts in a knot. It's also the term that's used when women are having contractions in labor pains. And sometimes you might spit or more when you're in those pains, right? So in other words, it's why I would say, you know, again, that surprising thing, the king is moved by this gut-wrenching plea. It ties his guts up into knots for this. And, right, the total surprise is the king does not even agree with this contractor to say, okay, I'll give you a loan and, you know, you try to repay me as things go along. But what he is saying is, I will cancel the loan. I will cancel the debt. You're totally free. Right. What a surprise. Unbelievable. There's grace. There's forgiveness. And if only the parable had ended there. Because then we'd all be happy and we'd be early for coffee break.
Save Michael another question.
Yes.
The parable of the gut wrenching loan, is that referring to the king or referring to the contractor?
It's referring to the king.
The
king hears this guy's plea, and it just ties him all up in knots. He's so right filled with compassion, pity, mercy, all those kind of terms work. So yeah, it's the term used to describe the king's reaction. All right, that's scene one. Scene two. A new scene, and again, it parallels the first scene quite a bit with a few little twists. First of all, verse 28. Okay. The slave who has been forgiven now, right, finds one of his co-slaves. One of the subcontractors. Remember, the first slave is brought in, was brought, right, kicking and screaming to the person to whom he owed the money. This slave now goes out to find the one who owes him money. Right? That's the first thing. And then, of course, the second thing here is that it's much less, $4,800, a payable sum, right? Give me a year or 2 years and a subcontracting tax collector would be able to pay that off. It's not that big a deal. So, you know. And the third difference, of course, is the way this first servant approaches the slave, right? Seizes him in a chokehold, right? He's going to literally squeeze the money out of him and all of that. Verse 29, of course, is a word-for-word repetition of verse 26, except there's no notion of prostrating yourself in front of the king, right? Because that would you would only do that in this context for a king or someone like that. But of course, the plea is word for word, right? Be big-hearted with me, and I will repay you. And then verse 30, the punchline in this scene. Now he was not willing to do this, but going out he threw him into prison until he might pay back the debt. Right, so that one, the first place, moved by this gut-wrenching plea. Second response here, not willing to do this. In other words, the same plea did not wrench this guy's guts. He didn't care. He was tough. All right. So at this point now, right, as we're ending here with this, not willing to do this, throws him into prison. How do you feel about all this in terms of the story? What's your reaction?
I'm pretty upset with the contractor.
You're upset with that first servant. Totally upset.
Always have been.
Always have been. Anyone else upset? Yeah?
Very confident I would never do that.
Very confident you would never do that. Well, why not?
She's so forgiving.
Yeah, come on.
No, I mean, that's so righteous, obviously.
Well, it wasn't very logical, was it? I mean, didn't he kind of, unless this guy had a lot of family and friends that would come forward, he's cut off any revenue he might have got out of this guy by throwing him in prison.
Well, yeah, but that's no, I mean, remember, we got a contract. You gonna let guys just break contract?
Well, like you said, he didn't.
You know, all those people, you know, that subprime mortgage garbage, and you know, now the rate goes up, they got to pay more mortgage. They can't do it, you know. You're the banker, you're Citibank, whoever. You're going to say, "Hey, that's okay. You just keep living in your house and pay me whenever you can." I think that's what happened down here, right? Contract's a contract. You can't pay Tent City. Right?
That's right. Unless you're AIG.
Unless you're AIG, right? But obviously this guy was not too big to fail. Right? Only $4,800. Pay it up. Break the contract. Mm-hmm. Peter.
Well, I side with the gentleman over there in the blue shirt because it says until he would pay the debt. And so how does, you know, any of these methods, that's why they don't have debtors in prison anymore. Yeah. Because until he can pay the debt, it would be never because he's locked up on bread and water. Yeah. Same thing with the torturing at the end. They're not going to get any money from those methods.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, this subcontractor would have contacts, as we can tell, with other folks in the boat, and maybe he could get a loan from those folks to get the money to pay the guy off, or who knows what. But I mean, you know, why is that our concern? I mean, a contract is broken. Has this first servant done anything illegal?
No.
Has he really done anything unjust?
Yeah.
No. What do you mean, yeah? Well, where's the injustice?
He's not treating his fellow servant as well as he was treated by the king.
Well, so what? So you know, why do we need bleeding hearts?
He's following the law.
Yeah, he's following the law. This is business. Come on.
Yeah, I think culturally. Well, he's just back to business as usual. The guy hasn't learned a gosh darn thing.
Well, why was he supposed to learn anything?
Well, because that's what we do in life. This parable has bothered me ever since I was a child. I thought he'd be so giddy that he'd just say, "Oh, go home," you know? Obviously, clearly, you know, this is nothing compared to what I was just relieved of.
Obviously, servant number one was a pretty good actor because he convinced him, you know, because he convinced him he was so penitent and everything like that, and it really wasn't true because otherwise he couldn't turn around and do this to the other person.
Michael, I think this story is a lot about power more than just money.
Well, that's certainly a part of it. Yeah, go ahead, say more.
Basically, it's the mafia business model.
that's not a bad metaphor for the way it works.
And it's based on power relationships.
Yes. Yeah. And so in that sense, again, right, you know, nothing wrong with this. Why are we dumping on this first servant, right?
Yeah, but the things like it is illogical to put somebody in debtor's prison. Well, it's not about the money. It's about the power.
Sure. And you don't break a contract. No.
Maybe that's the problem. Back up to the contract. He had no business making that contract in the first place to offer to pay something that he never could do.
Well, I mean, come on, I mean, don't we do that all the time? I mean, you take a mortgage out on the house, how do you know you're going to be able to pay it off? I mean, you think you can, but you never know. Something might happen, right? You lose your job, how are you going to pay your mortgage? Out you go. Right? So don't say he didn't have any business doing it. I mean, it's business, and there's always some risk involved.
Could be that the first servant, besides this big debt, they also had, he was broke, totally broke, and he wanted his money.
Well, sure. Yeah. Sure. But, you know, again, this guy doesn't do anything illegal, doesn't really do anything unjust, unless you're kind of bleeding hearts about that. I mean, you know, if I were this first servant and be accused of injustice or illegality or something, I would turn to my good friend Peter Thompson, defense lawyer extraordinaire, and he'd be able to get me off just like that by saying, nothing illegal here, nothing unjust here. He'd go, this is a piece of cake for me to win this one. Right, Peter? No.
I would like to distinguish between the words legal and just.
Okay, yeah, we can. But then I'll still be tough and say, but the guy didn't do anything unjust either.
I could say, I think that the use of words is so critical. And we, as a culture today, often use legal and just together. And I think we have a set of laws. And this man broke the law.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no guarantee. The laws are just.
Okay. What about the word ethical? I don't even know if that fits in here, but what about that word?
No, ethical doesn't fit. No, I'm not being flippant about that. I'm serious about that.
Well, I think it's the difference between justice and mercy. There's a story. Some of you people may remember baseball details better than I, but some baseball player missed a catch that would have won the World Series or something.
Yeah.
And I got the details, and then the next time he appeared in the ballpark, everybody booed, and the announcer said, let's not give him justice, let's give him mercy. Did I remember that right? But anyway, it fits.
I think it was a no-hitter type situation.
Well, that's right, right? I mean, I think now, right, this is, if we're trying to be precise about some of this, right? We can make differentiations. We know all about legal and how things can be legal but not necessarily moral or just or whatever, so we're not even going to worry about that one anymore. We can think about justice, and some of us are, but we can think about it here also in terms of making that distinction to say one might want to argue, and I'm being nasty about that, to say, well, this guy, this first servant, is still acting according to justice, but
right,
there will be no argument here. He is certainly not acting with any mercy. And what gets you so upset is because he's not acting according to mercy. Mm-hmm. But why should he?
Well, you know, in a lot of cases, the judge in the case has a range of punishments or options, or we can give the person, let him go. You know? Even though the jury says, you know, he has discretion of what he wants to.
Some discretion.
Some discretion, yeah.
So. Yeah. I first.
But why do you think, or why do you become so outraged that this guy didn't act with mercy?
If you didn't have the first sentence in there that says he got mercy, you wouldn't feel so bad about him not giving mercy. So it's the opposite of what he got that makes you so mad.
Okay.
Well, okay. And is it also that we see in ourselves a lot of, not in every case, but we see ourselves the same actions. We're human. We're broken. We're not always going to act with the same mercy that God gives us. So when we see this, we see ourselves in that, and so that's maybe why we get upset, because we're like, well, I don't know.
Well, all right.
He was.
We'll go up top, okay, and then we'll go to Bob. Okay.
I was just going to say, he was faced with the king to give mercy to one person. And if your financial calculations are right, he was faced with giving mercy to one or a thousand. I mean, so he the story seems to me to be overwhelmed with, it's possible he's overwhelmed with how much mercy he would have to display.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, but thinking, I mean, maybe this is just the first subcontractor that came to him. What happens if he has 12 more subcontractors that owe 48 or something? Yeah.
Okay. I'm just thinking. I was reading a couple of weeks ago in our country. In our country, we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. We have right now about I think it's set up. 1 out of 100 Americans are going to spend some time in jail. 10 million people a year rotate through our prisons. And most of, a good part of these are petty drug stuff, marijuana, some cocaine, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It costs $43,000 a year to house somebody in a prison for a petty crime. If you're in a big-time prison, it's over $100,000 a year. But if you pull the American public and ask them whether those people, the drug people ought to go to jail, as opposed to maybe showing mercy and providing some rehab for them, probably at a lesser price. I think most people would still say they ought to go to jail. I'll bet they would. They don't want them on the streets. They don't want them burglarizing their homes, looking for money. They want them the heck out of here. That's why we got so many people in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Rehab actually works for some of these people. It's probably cheaper. But we don't really think about mercy. We're thinking about, that's justice. I mean, he got caught. He did the wrong thing.
My youngest son was into drugs for quite some time, and it took 2 rehabs to get it through, but he finally did come out the other side. But it wasn't just the first rehab, it was the second.
One more comment. Michael? I seem to. Oh, yes.
I think one other word, if we put in there, I think is maybe why the natives are so angry here, including me. And that is fraud. It's a little bit, generally in between, justice and legal there. What, in terms of this particular event, when he picked up. He was trying to get to $4,800.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
What should he have done with a good portion of that $4,800 had he got it? Pay the king, and he had been forgiven. And so, we don't know exactly what he would have done, but say this guy, was able to go out and scrape up some money. I'm feeling, and I think other people are with me, that this guy would have just stuck in his pocket. He would have defrauded the king. So it would have been like throwing salt in the wound of that mercy that was given.
Well, there would be no defrauding because the loan was canceled. He didn't owe the king anything.
Yeah.
So
well, it would depend on his intent on the.
One more comment, and then we need to move on.
He could have had $2 billion of the $3 billion he owed. He was forgiven everything.
Yes.
And in a sense, possibly unjustly enriched. Which makes his behavior even more despicable.
Yeah, right? I mean, however you want to fill in those details in the story for your own interpretation, that's right. You could make him really, really nasty.
One more comment on scene two. This is just an excerpt from W.H. Auden's poem, Christmas Oratorio, which I just think is a great poem. You should all read it sometime. But this is where the crook in the poem speaks. And just these two sentences from Auden. The crook speaks and he says, quote, I like committing crimes. God likes forgiving them. Really, the world is admirably arranged. Isn't that great? Yeah. And our servant number one has got that crook's mentality, doesn't he?
So does Bank of America.
It's an admirable arrangement here that we have. All right. Scene three, right, where all the excitement happened, right? The co-servants, all these other subcontractors, if you will, witness this supposed injustice and are outraged, just like all of you were outraged. So, you know, you and all those other folks are in the same position. You agree. And they go and tell their story to the king, what happened. And of course, the king also is outraged. So the king, these co-servants, and I think all of you as hearers, all agree. This guy's, to put it in the king's words, evil. Right? Verse 32, the king says, evil slave. So already there, right, the king has passed judgment. Right, this guy's evil. So now all we have to do is wait for the punishment. And that's verse 34. And now note how extreme it is, right? The punishment now is even worse than it was back in verse 25. That now, again, verse 34, right, this person is handed over to the torturers until he might give back all that was owed. And again, we know this guy isn't going to be able to pay it back. And so, therefore, this guy is going to spend the rest of his life being tortured. And we know that that will probably be a long life because, right, to be a good torturer, the first thing you don't want to do is kill them. Because that just takes all the fun out of it. Right? Torture is basically to make people tell the truth. Right, that there's this notion that somehow under torture you'll tell the truth, so maybe he'll tell how he's been hiding a little money or something or whatever, but it's that sense of torture. And that's bad enough. But again, we have to put ourselves into this context of back then. This is not the shocking part of the story for the hearers. The most shocking part of the story is, again, remember in this Middle Eastern context, we have a king who has gone back on his word. Remember, back then, a royal edict is absolute. And when the king speaks and puts his signet ring on it and it becomes law forever and ever and ever. It cannot be changed. And this king changes the edict. He goes back on his word and says, no forgiveness. He reinstates the original debt and raises the punishment. So, you know, kind of three strikes and you're out stuff. That's what happens here. Go back on forgiveness, reinstate the debt, send him to the torturers. Now, right.
And therefore, here's the dilemma in the story. Mm-hmm. What do you do when a king goes back on his word? And a real dilemma is that often in interpreting this story, we like to say, well, you know, in this story, the king is like God. Do you really want to do that? You say, oh yeah, that's how God works, you know. God will forgive you once, then you screw up, and God will go back on God's word and say, forgiveness, shmorgiveness, hell. We're done. And what makes this even worse is, remember, the whole introduction and all of this before the parable itself is, we're supposed to forgive 77 times. That means to infinity.
It's 70 times 7.
Well, no, it's really just 77 times. I mean, you can translate it 70 times 7, but Jewish idiom is when you say 77 times, that's the way you say infinity. So, I mean, your point there, in that sense, we have no disagreement about what we're to understand by that. It means you always forgive. And now here, if you're going to make this king God, you're saying, well, God will forgive once, and then after that, it's just vengeance. So at least now we know God and the king can't be the same person here. So therefore, right, what is this parable trying to push us toward with regard to a sense of grace and forgiveness? Now let's think about it this way. Who is responsible for having the king go back on his word? Who caused all these problems to begin with? Who?
The first slave.
No.
Yes, the people are turned in.
The king, the tattlers.
The tattlers! All those co-servants. All those people who you agreed with. Because you were outraged too, and you say, you know, we ought to do something about that SOB. I'm going back to the king and we're going to tell him. And you all went, yeah, go for it. And now look at the mess we're in. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, but why did those people turn him in? Was it because they thought he was such a terrible person, or because they knew that they had debts that they couldn't pay back as well? I mean, it occurs to me that they were distressed, but they were distressed because they were going to get the same punishment as the first subcontractor got.
Perhaps, but at least if I judge what all of these interpreters out here said, they were all outraged because that first slave didn't show mercy. I mean, none of you are owing this first slave any money, are you? or look at it this way, you know, some of you owe me some money, don't you? Right? I mean, but I think, right, our responses were outraged because, as we said, this first slave, having been treated the way he was treated, did not act in the same way mercifully toward others. And we're outraged, and in that sense we all say, well, he really deserves, he should get what's coming to him here.
But I don't think he believed what he got the first time. I think when the king forgave him such an outrageous amount the first time, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. He was expecting the king to go back and say, now I gave you a year, I gave you 6 months, I gave you 5 years. You still have to. I think he was acting out of anxiety when he chased down the other guy, because he just wasn't, he couldn't grasp how big the forgiveness was.
Perhaps he couldn't grasp how big the forgiveness was, but I think, again, as I would want to say, within the context, right, the king's word is absolute, and therefore if the king says the debt's canceled, the debt's canceled. I mean, and obviously he got to walk out of the judgment hall, so it, you know, it's canceled. I think he believed that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can't make anybody live by grace. You can't make anybody live by grace.
No, you cannot make anyone live by grace.
So this suggests to me the person we're supposed to forgive is the first servant for being such a rotten guy.
Isn't that nasty? But now you're there, right?
That's what you're saying.
That's where we're going with this.
So it comes off that the king actually gave a conditional thing. He had conditions, even though there wasn't written, there was conditions in his forgiveness.
No.
Yeah, but he expected something, obviously, because otherwise he wouldn't have gotten back on it. It's like if I'm invited to a wedding or something, and I give a gift and I don't get a thank you, does it bother me? Is there a condition on that gift, or do I give it freely? Or do they expect a return?
No, because I think here the way I want to work with this story and get you to think about is, again, the problem folks in this story are the co-servants, are us. Because remember, you've agreed with them, and the story is constructed, right? It just sucks us right in, so we do agree. They go to the king, right, in that sense, and say, look it, this guy was not merciful in that, and there is, we've got some sense of outrage. It might be justice, it might be something else, but we're saying, you know, do something. This guy deserves retribution. This guy deserves punishment. And in that respect, the king says, okay, but in order for me to do that, I have to go back on my word. You know, the whole system in terms of the way you understand it and everything is now out the window. And we're basically, in a sense, a chaos.
Are we going to have time for verse 35?
Yeah, I was wondering about that too.
Yeah, that's
the problem. All these problems pale in comparison with verse 35.
Why do they pale?
These are human constructs, and you know we can learn to forgive one or another, but we expect much more of God. Look at 35.
Yep.
It's saying like God's going to not forgive and be a torturer on top of it. Yep.
Well, in that sense, that is the thing, right? Thusly, God is going to work that way in terms of, if you want to turn God into a God of justice and punishment and retribution.
Mm-hmm. That's where Christ comes in.
In other words, where the whole parable of grace comes in is and forgiveness is the sense that, right, when we who have been forgiven by a gracious God act in such a way that rather than living in grace and in forgiveness, want justice, retribution, revenge, getting even, that's the kind of God we also want. And so thusly, if that's how you act, that's how your Father in the heavens, God, is going to act too. Because if you will, that's the God you now construct.
Mm-hmm. So is this parable really about what a terrible king this is? Because he's ruled by his emotions, responds to them with this gut-wrenching, and then goes back on his word, and so the God you think you want is not really the God you want at all.
No, the parable is about what terrible co-servants we are, because we refuse to live when push comes to shove in a world of grace and forgiveness.
So since that's true, is the message that we're all going to be tortured by God?
No, but we're allowing ourselves to have a society where we're living out the torture right now, because we're not forgiving each other, and we're not, and so the world that we're creating and the society that we're creating is, in a sense, our living hell, and our, because we're not forgiving one another. And so God is saying, well, then you're going to have to live through a world where forgiveness and mercy is not at the forefront. I mean, is that what he's or
going in that direction. We'll go here and then we'll go back here.
I'm back in the words again. Maybe that's another word, punish. When we live in a world where there is a reason to punish human beings into death, or not into death, in torture. And we do need in a society some corrective responses to destructive behaviors. But the concept is so different if we use punish than correct. It's just like the use in law where you send somebody for rehabilitation. What? There's different ways to do it, but somehow the word has taken hold in humans in ways that I feel very, I'll use despair again, that are despairing.
Back there, and then we'll come up to you, Bob.
I just wanted to say that I think the king in the story is kind of the God that we deserve because of how we act here, but not necessarily who we're going to get because he is willing to forgive us for how we act here, but I think that's kind of who we deserve.
Bob?
So what you're saying is that, I think people here are thinking maybe what we're saying that we don't have a God of grace. But what the parable is all about is we do have a God of grace, but we don't live that way. We're like the coal servants, so that we think that God thinks like us.
Right. We don't live as if there is a God of grace because we don't live in grace. We don't live in that sense of having been forgiven.
We think this is the way God operates.
Unbelievable debt. And not only think the way God operates, but you see again in the bottom of our hearts, that's really how we want God to operate. Right?
Right.
So,
we want a God who rules.
I want a God who rules, and basically I want a God who's going to take care of those folks I don't like.
So we're putting ourselves again, as we were in several other sessions, in the role of judging others.
Yes, instead of forgiving. And recognizing that those others, no matter what they have done, are also forgiven ones of God.
So this parable is about we miss the point.
We miss the point. We just don't get it.
So God is, according to what we construct.
Oh, yeah. That's...
So your God's different than my God.
Yes.
Could be.
Because you put it together differently.
But I mean, I think it goes back to the first commandment, right? To have no other gods. But the thing is, we all have these other gods. We are all idolaters because we love to create and construct the God who we think will really do the job for us. Right? That's part of what sin is all about, making my own God. Right? You know, if you will, to turn Genesis 1 around, we say, let us create God in our image. And that's what those co-servants did. They wanted the king now to act in their image of what they thought was good and right and just. And it leads to absolute chaos and finally torture and death. And if it happened to that servant, you know, why won't it happen to me?
Michael, Jesus isn't saying the Father you construct will also do this to you. He says, so my Heavenly Father will also do to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. But who's he speaking to?
Time's up.
No. If you're willing to stay, I'll go for this.
Well, the line in the Lord's Prayer that always gives me the greatest pause is, forgive me my sins as I forgive those who sin against me.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up, because that's exactly where I want to go, and to say that is exactly what this parable is not commenting on.
Uh-huh.
In other words, again, the way Matthew sets things up, there's the Sermon on the Mount and the Lord's prayers in the Sermon on the Mount and all of that. And many of these parables are within Judaism again. A midrash will teach us on that. And we often look at this parable and say, yes, it's talking about the fifth petition of the Lord's prayer. I would want to propose, no, it's talking about the sixth and seventh petitions of the Lord's prayer. It is, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. In other words, God, help us whenever we are in those situations when we are tempted for revenge and retribution and all of that, to remember it's forgiveness and grace that counts. In that sense, don't tempt us with justice. Because as crazy as it sounds, your reign and rule is beyond even our ways of thinking about justice. Grace is even greater and more expansive than justice because it entails forgiveness. And we're so tempted to think otherwise. We're so tempted. And therefore, that's where the evil will come in. Because in that way, we end up doing evil against one another rather than justice. One more comment on this. It's also a midrash. Again, what comes quickly after in the Sermon on the Mount is also this saying, right? But this is verse Matthew 5, verse 39. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also.
We still haven't answered the question about verse 35, I don't think. I mean, I try to be forgiving as much as I can. I'm human, though. But it says, if you do not forgive your brother or sister from your heart, every time, your Heavenly Father is going to do like the king did.
Yes, but again, there's that key little adverb that starts out there, thusly. In other words, it's trying to make that connection logically to say, when you act this way, this is the way you construct your whole world. Right? In other words, it's that understanding. I mean, I'm just not that good at this, at putting it any other way than saying, right, most of the time what we want to do is construct God in our image. And when you do that thusly, Jesus is saying, then you know, my Father, that's how you're going to create God to be.
I'll go
back to Renee, and then we'll come back up front.
Luther's understanding of a wrathful God. That when we insist on living under the law, we will feel the full force of the law, right? And the end is death. And I think that he chooses to live under the law, so he's going to feel the consequences of the law. And in that sense, he refuses to live by grace. But Ray Luther says that's not who. It's only in our alienation from God that we experience God as a wrathful God. But in Christ, we experience God as a creature.
I have to, if you know To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus, at the end,
yeah,
he gets spit on by the guy who took the man's the life, and he looks at him and he takes in out his handkerchief and he wipes it off, and he just looks at him. I felt that. I thought about that as you were just describing what you said.
Mm-hmm.
It's just...
Go ahead.
Well, I've just, as you've been talking, kind of wrapping my brain around the idea of the co-servants assessment, and I'm realizing that the co-servants, in reporting all this, were really not all that concerned about their co-servant subcontractor number three. They were really focused on the first servant in punishment for him. That really was their focus of that.
Which was ours, right? That's what made us
exactly.
Outrage.
Yeah, nobody was focusing on the co-servant that was not for doing that.
One more quick comment. I mean, if we have lots of, we can link this up also with Paul's way of thinking. Just to cite, this is Romans chapter 3, verses 23 and 24. Since all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, they are now justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Ernst Käsemann, German New Testament exegete who spent his whole career studying the book of Romans, in his commentary and commenting on this verse. And again, I link it up with the kind of co-servants notion. He says what this verse and Paul is doing when he talks about justification. This is Käsemann, quote, justification attacks the religious person and only in so doing preserves the sense of justification of the ungodly. Grace is simultaneously judgment because it fundamentally sets even a religious person in the place of the godless.
Ooh. All right. You're
going to
leave us with that.
Because remember, I warned you, it's always worse than you think. See, you thought it was kidding.